Good evening and welcome to Yada Yada Radio. I am Craig and we have both Larry and Kirk with us. James today. How are you guys?
We're great.
We're doing good. I got to be Kirk's yes man today. Observation.
Yeah, I heard that. I heard that.
I like to say, thank you all for Larry showing up.
Yeah. You probably want to know why I canceled on you in the last minute, but it is a ignominious story. I was timed my flight from Charlottesville to Ohio so that I would get here in time to plug everything in and get ready for the show. But as I was taxiing after landing on a really narrow taxiway, it's only about 4 feet wider than my mains, I was trying to get everything done so I could shut down the plane quickly when I got it to the hangar. And I got the left main on the edge of the taxiway, and it just flung the airplane straight left and into I'd say the mud that it fell into was about 2 feet deep, almost crashed by propeller. I probably came within an inch of a $500,000 disaster, but as it turned out, it cost me a tip for the guys that helped me and some boards and some shovels and about 2 hours of digging out my airplane. Pull it with a backhoe.
That is a shameful story, no doubt about it. I've never had anybody tell me an ignominious story about themselves. But I gotta love it. That's pretty shameful, man. You screwed
it up. It is pretty shameful. I taxied my airplane off of the taxiway.
Good.
You know, here I flew it straight as an arrow from Charlottesville to Warren County, Ohio. I managed to do a beautiful landing in really tough conditions, even when the controllers bungled my approach clearance, still managed to get in under the weather, didn't avoid the icing, but managed to navigate through the icing. But I couldn't taxi after I landed. Obviously. Well, I can't.
That's your story anyway, right?
Okay. Yeah, but you know what I'm sticking with is that I thought, good at multitasking. But obviously, looking in the cockpit and fumbling through the dials and trying to stay on a narrow taxiway was more than I could handle.
Didn't work out, especially when you're on ice, probably. I want to bring something up before we start here. You know, obviously in this last Yobel, Yahweh calls the religious people, basically the people of the earth, Laodicea, which is the people legislate, as you know.
Right, people rule. And Western democracies.
I just want to read this little story here, and you tell me how apropos Laodicea is. Here it is. This is actually it's called the Home Office. The Home Office, and she's the Home Secretary, Theresa May, and this is in the UK. Child brides from overseas can legally enter Britain. Okay, think 19 9-year-olds being, you know, molested and raped. And the reason is because there was a legal loophole she didn't catch.
Yeah.
So it's not like rewriting the legislation would be in order. Nope. We've been defeated. So now 9-year-old girls can be molested by 60-year-old men or whatever
sex
age.
Right.
Yeah.
Hey, did you hear the latest people acting badly as it relates to pedophilia? Yeah, pedophilia. We've been haranguing the Roman Catholic Church because they are the living epitome of bad behavior.
Oh, sure.
And we've been haranguing the fundamentalist Muslims because their Quran authorizes rape and pedophilia because Muhammad was both a rapist and a pedophile. And then I think about a month ago I mentioned that one of the largest Protestant megachurch groups has been caught in a wide-scale sexual abuse fiasco. But yesterday I was reading a series of articles from an investigative journalist who has shown that the Hasidic, the super Orthodox Jewish communities in New York and Florida, that the rabbis are routinely abusing their young students, typically boys as young as 8-9 years old.
So their preference is boys as well. Okay.
Boys, their preference.
They should maybe join the Catholic Church.
They're not just. Yeah. Uh huh. Yeah. Exactly.
Mm.
Yes, indeed.
Wow. Yeah. So, this is typical. I remember when I first, I told you I did a lot of the political polling. In fact, the White House had me do the race relations survey for the Clinton White House. Okay.
Uh-huh.
But I did a lot of the focus groups and the major surveys in the political realm for Gallup, and I have to tell you, what we found out is that the people that were the greatest felons and had all the biggest problems with sex were the most religious.
Oh, of course. Yeah, that's exactly right. That's what we're finding here. And what's interesting is that the rabbis have a whole set of rules, of religious laws, and they call them religious laws, that they have established, and they call them Torah. That is their term for their religious laws, that preclude anyone from ratting them out. It's considered the most grievous of all sins to expose
right.
A criminal act perpetrated by a member of the community, particularly by a rabbi, to the secular authorities. And it's supposed to be a disgrace to Hashem.
Oh, wow. Mm.
Yeah. So they're
this is pretty astounding material.
As to whether or not children who have been sexually abused by rabbis should disclose the abuse to the authorities, or whether or not, for the sake of the rabbis and their great enlightenment, they should just
and hush
it to be abused. Yeah.
And the community says what to that?
The community there are two prolific message boards for the Hasidic community, and they're all subservient to the authority of the rabbis.
My God.
Yeah, I know. When you wonder why God hates, if you don't hate this stuff, and by the way, the Hasidic community is one of those communities. So you've got, in Christians, you've got the Mennonites and the Amish, and Islam, you've got virtually everybody, and in the Jewish community, you've got the Haredi or Black Hats or Shahs or whatever term you want to use for them. That all play religious dress-up. So these are people who are playing religious dress-up, and they are absolutely, totally, and completely revolting. They're just sexual perverts. Now, God doesn't really say a lot about sexuality. But when it comes to abusing a child,
mm-hmm.
that's just inexcusable. We ought to hate people to do that. Now, today you guys, as I understand it, Kirk, you included your program today, the one that I mixed because I was playing in the mud with my airplane, with the seven things that God calls an abomination, six of which he hates. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Let's start there and just go through that list quickly, and then we'll go on to what he has to say, because there's a lot more meat on this phone. Proverbs 6 just turned out to be a treasure trove. It was sent to us by William, the elevator man, is the one who sent it to us, and it turned out, well, it's the opening chapter now of the book of observations. And it begins, "Behold, presently these six things Yahweh hates, and seven are an abomination to his soul." Now, the next six things on the list all speak of five of the six are body parts, and the other is a byproduct of our body parts. The seventh one is in fact, different than the other six. But here they are. The first one is eyes, then we're going to go to tongue, hands, heart, feet, and finally, our breath, our soul. haughty eyes, visions of grandeur, people who have a rebellious attitude and perspective. Well, I want to tell you, you know, the clowns we've got running for president. You know, I was
what an insult to clowns! Give me a break.
I'm sorry. I was corresponding with Jerry McLaughlin, who's a just really good guy. He's the guy that was my publicist for all those years, and did it for, you know, essentially nothing. I mean, the guy was just spectacular, and he's a member of the Covenant family now. And we were talking about these guys, and because he's been asked to produce a movie on them, and I mentioned Cruise, and I said, you know, the guy is an absolute scumbag. I mean, he is a lying fraud. Everything the guy does is dishonest, and he's a complete sham. And he says, let me give you a personal story with Cruise. He said, Cruise came to me for a representation. He was doing something with the now governor of Texas, and they wanted me to get them publicity. I got them on a number of major television shows. My bill, because we had an agreement, is exactly what each show was going to cost them, was $13,000 when we were done. When I presented the bill to him, he says, you know, because we only had an oral agreement and you didn't get this agreement in writing, I'm not paying it.
Wow.
That was your
what a nice
Christian
guy.
Jim Cruise.
Mm-hmm.
And it was interesting that it ended up that it led to a lawsuit where now he's being challenged that he's not qualified to run for president because he was born in Canada. And the lawsuit actually grew out of the person he was trying to speak against, and that he got all the free publicity because he didn't pay for it. That person is the one that brought the lawsuit, and the cost to defend the lawsuit was like 50 times more than it would have been if he just paid the bill. Yeah, he's a genuine scumbag. Okay, so arrogance. God doesn't like arrogance, and he's speaking of arrogance here. Is, you know, your vision can be his testimony, or your vision can be your own visions of grandeur. And if they are the latter, he has no use for you. In fact, it's worse than that. He hates you. The next is the deceptive tongue. God hates misleading statements. They are the most deadly thing in the world. Hands that shed innocent blood. God is not pro-military, pro-troops. He doesn't have military heroes. God doesn't like it when we kill. A heart, and the heart means our motivations, our judgment, the perspective that guides our conduct. A heart which devises and writes idolatrous, unjust, and evil, troublesome plans. This is somebody that's motivated, as was Muhammad, as was Paul, as was Akiba, to devise and to create the scriptures of a religion. That's both an abomination and something that God hates. Next is feet, which rashly and impetuously run to and fro, darting about to approach that which is evil. Personally, I think this is the one that is an abomination, but is not hated. And I could be wrong, but the reason I made that conclusion, because there are six that are hated, seven are an abomination. So one of the seven is an abomination, but not hated. You know, when you're talking about God's perspective on something, you probably don't want to do something that he views as an abomination. But you most certainly don't want to do something that is both an abomination and he specifically hates it. And the reason I think this one is just an abomination, as if that is a significant distinction, is that I don't think God knows the people who rashly and impetuously follow after evil. I think he knows the people who do that conceive and devise and write religious plans, because he's going to try and condemn them.
Who purposefully mislead others,
right,
but
right.
The deceived
yeah.
are just dead.
Right.
Yeah, they're just dead.
The people who run after the religious, I don't think that's hated by God. I just think he views it as disgusting, as abominable, but doesn't hate them, doesn't know them. Then the next one is a maligning soul whose breath utters sedition, breathing out slanderous and deceptive testimony, which incites the deluded to worship false gods.
That's amazing.
And this person is acting as a false witness. So right now you're getting to political leaders, religious leaders, academic leaders, media spokespeople. This is somebody whose career path has put them in a position where they are enamored with their own testimony, and what they're saying is decidedly untrue. And the last one, I think, is the killer. I think the last one is the one that God despises the most. Then the one who claims to be sent out as a messenger to do away with something important, creating controversy and contentious strife between brothers. There is a significant aspect of Akiba here, because Akiba definitely, he didn't specifically demean the Torah. In fact, he didn't even come close to demeaning the Torah. He tried to establish the Talmud as more important than the Torah. And with Muhammad, he didn't try to do away with the Torah, prophets and psalms. He didn't know diddly squat about them. While both of those guys did create a fair amount of contentious strife between brothers. I mean, Akiba had the fingers lopped off of those who didn't accept Bar Kokhba as the Messiah. So both did that. But the guy that was really antagonistic between fellow Jews and that did away with something that's not just important, but the most important thing of all, and the one who claimed to be sent out as a messenger, and so meeting all three criteria, was Paul.
Yeah. You know, Larry and I took a different tact on this, and what we did is we took the seven list of seven, and we tried to figure out if there's any way Paul didn't fit into them. You know, it was just Paul scored. Everywhere we looked.
Particularly because Paul was egotistical, right? So the haughty eyes. Yeah, he fits that deceptive tongue. Everything Paul said in his speeches are recorded in Acts. Everything he said was dishonest. His hands that shed innocent blood. He began by saying that he was a murderer.
Mm-hmm.
A heart which devises and writes troublesome and idolatrous plans. Well, for Paul. Now, feet which rashly and impetuously run to and fro to approach that which is evil. As we found out in a number of the specific Pauline denunciations, which talk about Paul
running the great race,
walking all over the place, traveling all over the place, this is, unlike the others, this is absolutely Paul. And, of course, 6 and 7 are the epitome, the very essence of Christianity.
Well, one of the things I did today was just opened up with Zechariah and Malachi. I don't know if you've heard that, but, you know, I mean, you don't know anything about these men. They're not sitting around saying, I say, or I'm the best, or I'm the greatest teacher of all time. I've studied under the best religious teachers there ever were in the history of man. They just say, hi. This is the year, and the voice of Yahweh come to me, and here we go. And that's it. That's the end of it.
Yep. You know, I was. You guys may have had a chance to read this, and I don't know if you have or not, but I'm in the fourth chapter of Observations. And this is the first time, and now I think it's in the range of 9 or 10,000 pages of written material. It's the very first chapter that I've actually made it personal. Where, you know, if you read some of the prophets, there are, whether it be Moshe, you know, get the whole scenario, all the things that he and God did together, or, you know, if it's Samuel, all the conversations that he and God have together and what they did together, and Abraham, where they went together and what they ate together. I'm not claiming to be in their league, but there are some examples of that. And so this one chapter is the first and probably will be the only chapter that I tell a personal story. And it's because the subject matter is the 91st Psalm.
Mm-hmm.
And the 91st Psalm is the psalm that started all of this. It's when I asked God for the three things that if I was going to go off and and expose and condemn Islam, I requested three things. That we work together, I would not work independently. That he be responsible for all of the promotion of the message, and number three, that he would protect my family and home. The home would be a safe sanctuary, and my family would be wholly immune from attack. And he said, you know, if you, first of all, fine, agree to all three of those, but if you want affirmation of it, it's in your right pocket. And in my right pocket was the 91st Psalm. And I couldn't translate it at the time, but I could read it, you know, and read it in an English translation. And even in an English translation, it was more than sufficient to convince me that, yeah, this is specifically what I had asked for. And now that I'm actually going in and translating every word, almost every line of it gives me goosebumps as how specific it was. But that's the first time. And all of this time that I've ever shared a personal experience. Because in this particular case, I thought that the personal experience of how we began this relationship might, you know, be interesting. Because it, you know, it led to all these translations and all these discussions. And
a lot of truth being spread throughout the world, actually, truth be told.
Yeah, it turned out to be a really good thing. And then my hope was that when you people have a chance to read that and to say, all right, this is what we did, and this is how we did it together, lots of other people say, you know, shoot, I can do that too. That sounds like fun. Well, I want to do that. And, you know, and the fact is, and this is one of the things that Scott said earlier today when we were communicating, because he had started to read that chapter. You know, one of the things about relationships is that each of us has a relationship with Yahweh. They're all different because we bring different proclivities, different interests, but different experiences to the relationship. If mine is the worst of the three, then I'm a very happy guy. I'm enjoying mine. And mine is not in any way, you know, it's not a competition. I'm not deterred in any way if mine was the worst of the three.
It's not a zero-sum game, that's for sure. And I doubt if yours is the worst anywhere. yeah, you're actually a fun guy. I mean, I know this for sure. You're a fun guy. But you know what? Everybody, that's the whole thing. Everybody's bringing a lot of differences and different perspectives and different attitudes and all kinds of things. But the one thing we can all agree on is we want to meet Yahweh, and we're going to listen to his words to find that path. It's the Torah is a map. You know, I mean,
there are things that I like, you know, that I personally like in relationships. I like strong personalities. I mean, I like people who don't take any guff, that stand up for what they know to be true. I like strong personalities. I like people that like to have fun. I like to have fun. And I love an intellectual discussion where you're discovering things you didn't previously know. Those things for me, that's fun. But, you know, other people have different things that they like. You know, some people just like the reassurance, the comfort, you know, just the enjoyment of being together. So it's everybody's got a different thing, and the more different we are, the better the aggregate relationship between all of us is going to be. All right, so the reason that I am of the conclusion that what you guys did today is accurate, that all seven apply to Paul, is because of what God says in 6:20. Let me read it. My son, choose to be spared and remain safe by closely observing, attentively focusing upon, so as to be protected and preserved by complying with the directions and the terms of the binding relationship agreement of your father. And do not actually forego or reject the Torah, which is the teaching and guidance of your mother. If the solution is the terms and conditions of the covenant and the Torah in which it is presented, if that is how you avoid being an abomination and being hated by God, or more importantly, if that's how you avoid being seduced, to be plagued by those, the individual representing those seven things. If the answer is the covenant and the Torah, then the perpetrator is Paul. You don't have to know diddly squat about the Torah to know Muhammad was an absolute perverted scumbag.
Sure.
All you have to do is read the Quran, and you say it's the dumbest book ever written, worst book ever written. You don't have to know anything about the Torah to know that it was completely untrue. But Pauline Christianity? I think you do. Now, would you be capable of recognizing that Paul was a fraud if you just compared Yosha's statements to Paul's statements about him? Sure.
Yes.
Would you know that Paul was a fraud by just looking at what Paul said and then how he contradicted himself, or even the things that he said about himself, like he's demon-possessed, he's insane, he's a sexual pervert, you know, he's ruthless.
Sure.
I mean, yeah, sure. But because of the position that society has placed him, and because of the place where his letters are set within the religious text of the Bible, I mean, it takes some pretty significant, you know, chutzpah to say, you know, I think this guy was a scumbag.
Right.
And so,
I mean, you have to be
ruthless
doing it and having that many people have walked away and said, no, you, I can't take it. No, sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, if you are open-minded, the first thing you're going to recognize is that this notion that God picked a man to contradict everything that he had to say, to annul everything he had to say, and then to come up with an entirely different plan because his plan failed, has got to be the most ludicrous, irrational, just stupid statement that's ever been issued in the name of God. Yeah. So, but that said, it really isn't until you know the Torah that Paul becomes laid bare. And so the antidote for Pauline Christianity is the Torah. I would go as far as to say that if you understand the Torah, it's impossible to be played for a fool by Pauline Christianity.
Well, you know, and that's true, but there's some in Messianic Judaism that are, and the excuse that they make, and this you know, it's just important to point this out in case any of them might be listening, is that what they've done is rewritten Textus Receptus, because it's got all the same mistakes as the Textus Receptus, so you know that's where it came from. They've rewritten that into Aramaic, and I think some into Hebrew. And then they claim these are originals when they're not. They're just knockoffs.
Yeah.
It's like,
yeah, what I've heard
you said
it
in English, I wrote it back
in
Hebrew.
Right, right. They take the the Aramaic text of the Christian New Testament, the earliest extant variation of it. I've heard there's a lot of Messianics that pretend like this is the original, and that, you know, recently found that sort of thing. But that text, the oldest text, dates to the 5th century. By that time, there were tens of thousands of Greek texts, tens of thousands of them. And so the things that we know for certain is there was no part of the so-called Christian New Testament that was written in Aramaic. And that all of the translations, and we have 69 texts that are copies of the Greek dating to the end of the 1st, 2nd, and 3rd century, that is an absolute impossibility if the original was in Aramaic. Absolute impossibility. So it's a complete fraud. I guess what they attempt to do then is they then replace nomos with Talmud or something like that to make it appear that Paul is criticizing the Talmud.
What they do is just rewrite his words to soften everything and make it look like he may have been misunderstood here and there. That's what they do. You know, the amazing thing is, and this is how you know it's fraudulent from the start, is it's got the exact same canon as a Christian New Testament. You know, that's impossible. I mean, those
let's just go with it. If God in Chabaok said that Shaul is the plague of death, and he lays out this testimony in the sixth proverb that only applies to a single individual, that's Paul, then if you have a religious text that includes Paul's letters, it can't be inspired by God.
No. Correct.
Straight up.
Yep. The bottom line is that Paul promoted the gospel of salvation through faith by grace. There is no such thing in the Torah. And that's what God is saying here. He said, if you closely examine and carefully consider the instructions and conditions associated with the covenant, then you're not going to be fooled into this stupid notion that there is a New Testament, that there is a new covenant. You will not be fooled, because you'll understand what the terms and conditions are of the covenant, and that they never change. And that if you accept the Torah, you'll know that the Torah says don't add anything to it. There can't be a New Testament that contradicts the Torah, particularly since the Torah has a method of determining whether or not a person is speaking for God or not, and Paul violated every aspect of it. By the way, while we're speaking of God violating or somebody violating every aspect of the test, J.B. Spoke last week about encouraging us to do a review of Enoch.
Oh, I've been loving that.
He has actually completed a review of Enoch. And it is so overwhelmingly devastating to the book of Enoch that there is no reason for us to add anything to it. But we are going to chime in as a peanut gallery when J.B. presents it. J.B. is out with his wife this evening. This is one of her last outings. She is very pregnant, and something she wanted to do. So they're out this evening. Otherwise, we would have done it tonight. But we will, on either observations, probably on this program, because he works during the observations recording. We're going to absolutely destroy any credibility of Enoch. In fact, Enoch is so stupid, it's almost Quranic stupid.
I was going to say that. I read it like 20 years ago, and it was too dumb to keep reading.
Well, I mean, it's a very bizarre. I mean, you look at the... I mean, one of the things he comes right out of the box with, and to be honest with you, I've been really buried in work, so I've read several pages of it, and I'm going to really get into the meat of it tomorrow, but I got into where, he talks about this guy meeting with Enoch and that guy meeting with Enoch, and he says, by then Enoch was already gone from the planet, according to the Torah.
Oh, yeah.
He says, for a guy that's gone, he sure hangs out on the earth a lot,
He was there and then gone, and then what in the world? I mean, he is the one that is dealing with all the instructions related with Noah with the flood, and yet he was gone 600 years before then. I mean, the whole thing is just, and most of it reads scientifically and historically, it reads like the Quran. I mean, it's unbelievably stupid.
Some of it, the flood presentation, where you got this star that fell on and became a white calf and all the animals.
That lightning comes from the rotation of stars.
Yeah, and all this time, I thought that what was really going on was that Noah listened and he took these instructions and he was actually building an ark, because he heard his instructions.
Yeah, I thought when God said in Bereshit that he spoke to Noah and provided the instructions to Noah, and that Noah engaged and acted upon them, that's the way the story actually occurred. And particularly now, since we have absolutely proof that it occurred exactly as God said, and when God said it occurred, and where God said it occurred. I was pretty convinced that that's the real scoop, but no, not according to Enoch. Now, there is two aspects of this that I think would throw most people for a loop of what we just said. He says that you should closely examine and carefully consider. No big deal. That we are all on the same page there. Maybe it's a big deal, the biggest deal of all. But we're all on the same page that you have to, Shamar. You have to. But this actually is Netzar, which means it's a form of observation which includes your salvation. So choose to be spared and remain safe by being observant. And the things to observe are the mitzvah, which are the directions in terms of the binding contract, the prescriptions, conditions of the covenant instructions from the father to his children regarding the family. And God is taking credit for that. He's the father of the covenant. So that's his thing. He's the father of the covenant. But you know, he is assigning credit to the mother for the Torah. You know, never forego or reject. In other words, don't do as Paul suggested. With the Torah teaching and guidance of your mother. What do you think that's about?
Well, I think Paul hated women. I really believe that.
Yeah, I do too.
He had nothing nice to say about them. He wanted them excluded everywhere. And the mother is clearly the set apart. It's the Ruach.
Right.
And
right.
It's the Ruach that feeds the Nesama. It's, right. It's how we understand the Torah.
You know what's really interesting here, too? This is not the religious adaptation for this, for Easter, Eshtar. And for Mary, Queen of Heaven, Mother of God, and for Astarte, Queen of Heaven, Mother of God, is that there is a consort of God. God's not saying, my queen. It's not the Torah of my queen. It's not the Torah of the Queen of Heaven. It's not the Torah of the Mother of God. Because God doesn't have a mother. It is the Torah of your mother. And so the only mother we have associated with the Torah is the set-apart spirit. It's our spiritual mother. Now, what this does, I think, is this is one of like a dozen places we've come across recently that reaffirm what may have been one of the most significant stretches that I've taken in translation when I said that there are four of the Mikra which say that God wants us to answer the invitation and come into the presence of the maternal manifestation of his light. That Isha was a maternal manifestation of the light of God. It's the feminine of fire. And it also means woman and mother. This is one of those places it's affirming that.
It's a confirmation. And it's a confirmation just like honoring your mother and father, and that ain't mom and dad. Kids,
that is correct.
You know,
that is exactly.
That's another affirmation.
Yeah,
your other big affirmation.
When it says, "Yeah, you should view with great respect and view as enormously significant your father and mother." Well, he has now explained who your mother is. She is the Torah.
Well, yeah, it was not her because my mother didn't teach me the Torah.
I just want to add one other thing there, and this is important. It might have been a stretch for a moment, but then when we see Malacca, female messenger, right in that statement where we're to be approaching the mother and not to do the work of the Malacca,
And the Malacca would be our spiritual mother.
Yeah, absolutely it would be.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
So you were dead on, right? And everybody else has it wrong, and they have for years. Because why? Because that's a pillar. You know, in Rabbinic Judaism, it's not a pillar, but in Rabbinic Judaism, this is an attack to call the Ruach.
Yeah, and by the way, I'm not, as you know, I'm not gloating that I got that right. It brings great satisfaction, though, when you spend as much time as I spent trying to understand what it meant to answer the invitation and come into the presence, because those two verbs were really clear. Answer the invitation, come into the presence on these 4 days, and then of the Isha, and you look at Isha. What does it mean? You know, it's the feminine of fire. Yahweh uses the masculine of fire to describe his presence on the top of Mount Horeb, and the column of fire by night that he led the Israelites through the wilderness. And so the masculine Ish is Yahweh's light as the father. The Isha, which is the feminine of it, got to be the light of the mother. I mean, that's the way it, that's just the thing that seemed to be the most consistent, the most rational, the most logical, the most fact-based explanation. And isn't that, you know, when we come into the presence of the maternal aspect of Yahweh's light on Yom Kippur, on Matzah, aren't we then enveloped in the Torah and therefore made perfect by God?
Right. Yes, beyond that, if you know, if you start getting into lighting fires on altars and all kinds of nonsense,
right?
You know,
right.
If you misread
no,
that,
God's not asking you to light the fire. The fire's already lit. Just come into the presence.
Right.
Of it.
You
know,
sure.
And what, you know, and if you want to look at the spiritual mother, the role that she plays in the garment of the Torah, the garment of light that we're adorned on, and matzah, which is the means to perfect us, because with light there is no darkness. Light isn't the opposite of darkness. It's that with light there is no darkness. It eliminates all darkness. It doesn't just make us look perfect in God's eyes. It makes us perfect. But what is the result of Masa, Bakodom, being born, firstborn children.
Yes.
So it's you come into the presence, the feminine presence of Yahweh's light, leads you directly to being born into Yahweh's family, and that's our spiritual mother. So it's,
and just I mean, just it's, for one more solid confirmation, I want you to look at Yoab, Yaslan, 32:8, and it says, "Indeed, the spirit, she." And mortal
right.
man, and
right.
even the Nesama of the Almighty provide understanding. So
right.
anybody who wants to say that the Ruach, the Spirit, because that's exactly what it says, Ruach, who, she, in mortal
right.
man, that's it, she.
Right.
You can try to slice it any way you want. You might not like your what Yahweh says as opposed to your traditions. That's
right.
what it says. That's it.
And by the way, the other thing that's really powerful about that is that the she is as the spirit and the Nesama are linked together because
yes.
it's the Nesama that we use to connect to benefit from the enlightenment of the set apart spirit. That's the processor we have that's associated with our soul. It's the literally the processor that processes the words of the Torah so that we come to understand them. So you definitely have to put your nesama in gear. Choose to unceasingly fasten them upon your heart, continuously electing of your own free will to place them as an adornment upon your neck. So you think that God wants us to take the mitzvah, which are the instructions of the Torah, the covenant, and the Torah, and to do a little open heart surgery and shove it right on in there? No. Methinks that this is you have to understand what heart means in Hebrew, and heart is in Hebrew, you know. In English, we think of the heart as the seat of emotions, not in Hebrew, with the liver that was the seat of emotions, not only in Hebrew, but in the ancient world. The heart is the place that if you take something to heart, it shapes your perspective, it shapes your ambitions, it is the...
Your persona.
Your persona, and it's the place where you process information and exercise judgment to make the decisions as to what you're going to do with your life. So if the terms and conditions of the covenant and the Torah's instructions are at the place where you process your information as to make informed and rational decisions, then, in fact, they're going to do you the most good. You know, Larry, you mentioned that there are Messianics who know aspects of the Torah that are still Pauline, and my sense is the reason is that while they may know some of what the Torah says, particularly in English translations, they haven't taken it to heart.
You probably no. They, still, of course they haven't because they still have obeying laws, faith. Their faith. This all comes into play with these people.
Yeah, sure.
You know.
Now the second part of it, and elect of your own volition to place it as an adornment upon your neck. I suspect that's for two reasons. One is that our soul and breath are the same word, and it is the the very breath of life. And so, if it's on your neck, it's literally the breath of your life. But also, it is our neck that we have our larynx, our voice box,
mm-hmm.
that we use to form our words,
to talk.
Yeah, sure.
Right. So I think it will influence your speech, lend to it your attitude and your speech. Now,
especially when we're talking about judgment here, which is what really they're talking about with your heart. You know, that's what forms your character, and that's, it manifests itself in the way you make judgments. You know, there was a time in my life when, there's might be something that someone said about a conservative politician, and I might jump in there and agree with them, and somebody say something about a communist or liberal politician, and I would help pound them down. Today, if somebody said about either, I would attack both sides. That's because that's a part of my makeup now. It's a part of what I've decided to go ahead and just tear the pillars of both those sides down, because I realize none of them are telling the truth, and the only truth that really counts is Yahweh's words. And since I've yet to see a political actor on the world stage anywhere that said anything honest about Yahweh.
I don't think
there is one anywhere.
No, there isn't. There is none. I mean, literally none. There is no politician leading any country that knows Yahweh. Not one. There is not a single religious cleric in the world that knows Yahweh. There's not a single media spokesperson that knows Yahweh. There is not a single prominent individual in any walk of life, in society, in the media, in entertainment, in sports, in the military, in politics, or in religion. Not one that knows Yahweh.
And that's bad. That's horrible.
It's something about the state of the world.
Not at all. I think it's actually a good thing.
Well, that don't like me.
We
built this giant society with all this knowledge and all this system.
That does not make me sad, because I don't really like those people.
Well,
I don't want to spend my eternity with those people. I'm happy to spend my eternity with you guys. The thing that makes me sad is when Yashayahu, you're reading over and over in Yashayahu, and God is saying, I was looking for somebody, one person, couldn't find a soul.
Anybody.
Couldn't find anybody.
And nobody.
Yeah, I remember I said something about the misquote that they did in there was a movie recently about a tank crew called Fury. And what I said about that movie was it really does show the base aspects of humanity in war.
Right.
And that's what was good about it. Now, they misquoted that. It's so funny because you had been talking about that passage, a month or two earlier, where Yahweh said for 400 years he couldn't find anybody. He said, I know, I'll choose me. I'll choose myself. And they quoted that, meaning they needed to be chosen to take care of this great task. It was just...
Yeah, go blow people up.
And it was, it was a total misquote. It was just total misquote.
It was. Sure. Yeah. Amazing. In your walking, she will continuously lead and guide you, accompanying you. When you rest, she will watch over you. Just marvelous concepts here in terms of understanding who God is, what God is offering us, every aspect of this. This idea that there is a specific purpose of the set apart spirit, and the set apart spirit has a job to do, and God is it's not beneath God to assign that aspect of himself to help us in this way.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you a quick question.
Sure.
Why is it an English Bible would use Shamar here and actually do it as watch, or you do it as observe, to watch over, and then they'll use it as obey everywhere else?
Yeah, isn't it amazing?
I mean, what, they just get to choose whenever for no reason?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I know it's a rhetorical question.
Yeah. Like, now there really is an aspect of Shamar. Now 99% of the time the Shamar is used, it does mean to
observe,
to close things very carefully.
Watch over.
Yeah. Now there is a derivative of Shamar, of observation, that is also germane to the word. Matter of fact, I was dealing with it as I was translating the 91st Psalm. There is an aspect of Shamar where in this particular case, it happened to be Yahweh's Malach. And Yahweh had specifically assigned his Malach to a task relative to those who were carrying out something he wanted done. And their job was to pay attention, yes, to watch over, to observe. But it was actually to go that next step. You know, this is an engaged watchman. You know, if you watch over the Torah and you act upon it, then you're preserved by it. These Malach were shamaring, but their role was more than just observing. Their role was actually to engage, to protect.
Well,
so
I mean, if you're a shepherd,
you know, watching like a shepherd,
the wolves are attacking the sheep. You know, I mean, they need to do something.
They're not just going to watch. So there is an aspect of Shamar which can be deployed to go to actually respond in the appropriate way to what you're witnessing.
Yeah, but that fits in fine with shepherd and sheep. I mean,
yeah, it does. Oh, it does. And the word actually that is translated obey is not shamar, it's shama. And shama means to listen.
That's true. Yeah.
So it's the word that's translated listen that has been convoluted to obey, unless it's written in a context where obey is just too stupid for words, and then they acquiesce to listen. But there is no etymological connection between this idea of listening and obeying. When you awake, she will communicate with you, enabling you to seriously consider the situation and the instructions. She will direct your attention to the content and provide guidance. That's the role of the set-apart spirit. She is there to counsel us, to enlighten us, to guide us, to protect us, to watch over us, to perfect us, to nurture. A big job.
Mm-hmm.
And God has specifically set part of himself apart for this specific purpose, to perfect, to enrich, to nurture, to teach, to guide, to enlighten, to empower his children. Why God says in the statement that he etched in stone, you ought to have a very high level of respect for what your mother does in this regard, as well as your father's covenant.
I think he said in the stones too, didn't he?
Yeah, wrote in stone, etched in stone.
Well, yeah, isn't that also an aspect of nearly every religion other than Wicca? I mean, just about. I guess in India they have some real wicked goddesses, but it's just permeates religion that women are the idea of Yahweh having a feminine side is just a nurturing side is just thrown in the trash. It just doesn't exist.
Correct.
But if you think of it as the
Why is that? I lost one of my closest friends, when I was back in the Prophet of Doom days, when I came to realize that the Ruach Kodesh was feminine, and this individual was a woman. And she just said couldn't deal with that. You know, her God could not have a feminine characteristic.
Mm-hmm. Well, an old Hebrew thought, though, is the woman is the glue that holds the family together, so that would be totally in total type of concept for our family, the Bereth covenant. I mean, that's...
Correct. Well, you can't have a family without a mother.
Yeah, it's totally consistent.
You can't have a family without a mother. Yeah, the mother is the nurturer. She is there's so many important roles of mother, and there are no children without mothers. No life without mothers. So it is it's important for God to have a maternal aspect to his nature. Now, this goes on to say, for indeed, the prescriptions and conditions of the covenant, the mitzvah, are a lamp illuminated by olive oil, and the Torah is a light. Well, you know, we just learned that the Torah was of our mother, and now the Torah is light, which means that Torah equals light equals set apart spirit, which means the set apart spirit is light.
I see the word light in Paleo Hebrew in Torah.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, right in the middle of Torah.
Rash.
Yeah.
Right there.
Yeah. OWR or is light. In fact, somebody was writing me at the beginning of this program, you know, how'd you come up with enlightened free will for Aaron's name? Well, you've got OWN right in the middle of it, OWR, in the middle of it, which is the Hebrew word for light. And it's also a blend of the Hebrew word for ark, and ark is free will. And so it's a blend of those two. Now, how I did the study back there when I first came across Aaron's name and then looked at the component parts and came up with it, and I wrote how I did it in the chapter. I mean, my memory is not good enough to remember every detail. But that was the gist of it. But the thing here that is just so powerful is that you've got, I think, two things. One is that the Torah is light, and the terms and conditions of the covenant are a lamp. Now, the difference between light and a lamp is that while both produce, a lamp is a small, finite implement that will produce light, but you know it's not going to light up the world. It's not going to light up even a large room. So that makes the mitzvah a subset of the Torah. Both are lights. It's just that one is a much brighter light than the other. And while the terms and conditions of the Torah of the covenant are the most important aspect of the Torah. The Torah itself is a light that illuminates this lamp, which is the terms and conditions of the covenant. And what you have to understand too is that lamp isn't an ordinary lamp; it's an olive oil lamp. Mm-hmm. And of course, olive oil represents the spirit. The olive is the longest lived tree in that part of the world. The olive oil is nurturing. The olive oil was used to anoint. The olive oil was used as a healing salve, and the olive oil created the purest light. All of those aspects of olive oil. And there was an olive oil lantern that stood proudly in the temple, the menorah. Glowing and on the form of olive oil light, God's 6+1 plan. You know, I've got I made an addition, by the way, speaking of 6+1. Roy wrote something additional for the first chapter of Observations, and I had an occasion to talk about the 6+1 plan and Yah being 7-dimensional. And what he said is true, and I just integrated it into the chapter. And it's interesting for our future that while Yahweh cannot create a 7-dimensional universe, he can't create an 8-dimensional universe. He can create a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, or 6-dimensional universe. And he's not limited to one of them. In other words, if you've got a lot of of energy and a lot of questions and a lot of curiosity, and you want 20 of them, he can create 20 six-dimensional universes for you. And this, the idea here is that we can all have our own six-dimensional universe. We can also all have many six-dimensional universes. We can all choose to share a six-dimensional universe. But we'll all come to the seventh dimension together to share our experiences. And I think it's just an interesting way of knowing how eternity is going to work out for us. Mm-hmm. That we'll be able to experiment and play and just have a good old time in a universe that is infinitely beyond what we're able to perceive now, because we're really three dimensions stuck in the fourth. And with each dimension you move up, the change is infinite from the previous dimension. So we have an infinite increase from 3 to 4, 4 to 5, 5 to 6. And then when we actually have an infinite increase again from 6 to 7, but when we go from 6 to 7, we're outside of the six-dimensional universe, and at that point, mano a mano with God.
Yeah, well, you know, and I'd better have a lot more brain power to handle all this.
Yeah, and that is a huge part of it. Boy, as I was going through the 91st Psalm, there is a whole lot of reference to our brain power being increased. But our brain power is increased as we go through the 91st Psalm. We're going to find out that all of it is derived from the same strategy. You use your eyes to observe, you process what you see, you make the right connections, and that God assists us all the way along in that process that we understand. But yeah, we're all going to need considerably more brain power. So this the fact that the Torah is light means that the Torah, unlike what Paul said, cannot have a conclusion. Light is infinite. Light exists throughout all time. And since Yahweh says he is light, and since he says the Torah is light, the Torah and Yahweh are the same. Now, it's interesting, too, is that Yahochanan called Yahusha light, which means the Torah and Yahusha are the same. Now, all of that means that Christianity cannot be true. If Yahweh is light, his testimony cannot be pornography.
No.
If Yahweh is light and his Torah is light, then Yahweh and his Torah are the same. And you cannot annul God any more than you can annul his Torah. That's what all that means. And it also means, since it was the Torah of our mother, that the set-apart spirit is exactly as we have depicted her. She is light. And that there is no separation between Torah and set-apart spirit. They are the way of lives for relational discourse about being right. Maybe as powerful a statement as you could possibly make in context. And it's not the way of life. It's chayim, lives. They are the way of lives. So how, and it's they, so he's still speaking of the terms and conditions of the covenant and of the Torah and of our spiritual mother and of the light, but they are the way of lives. Why do you think it's plural? Why lives?
You mean the way of lives?
Yeah, why lives?
Oh, well, there's thousands that find this way of life. That's why.
Yes, yeah, that's true. And there really are two lives. We have eternal life in Yahweh's family. That's the grand one. But, you know, this life, you know, I know, Larry, you've got some aches and pains. And, you know, today I got to play in the mud. There are some aches and pains in this life, but this life's a pretty good life. You know, once we found Yahweh, this is really, I'm having a grand time.
Well, I can say this. I'm no longer confused. I mean, you know, it's pretty confusing if you don't know the truth. It really is.
Correct.
You know,
right.
Didn't you used to think, and I really want people to consider this, because I used to consider, what sacrifice can I make? I mean, I was that
right.
stupid. I mean, I full on admit it, too. But didn't you feel like, where's my purpose? What should I do?
Mm-hmm.
You're waiting
oh,
for
sure.
this purpose.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the purpose is, you know, when I first heard you say this for the first time, I thought, of course, you know, Yahweh's purpose is the same for everybody.
Yeah, let
the truth be known, and they share
right.
the truth. That's it. There's no
right. yeah.
more purpose
right.
than that.
There is nothing. Yeah.
Right.
And we enjoy the relationship together. And that really is, that makes this life wonderful. I'm very happy with this life. So they are the way of lives, of this life and the eternal life. And there are a lot of us. There are thousands of us. So they are the way of lives. So if you want to live, the means to live, the terms and conditions of the covenant and the Torah in which they are found, and to become part of that light. And for rational discourse about being right, this one trips my trigger because, you know, we talked about at the beginning of the show, everybody's got a different approach to relationships. We bring different proclivities. We have different interests. My personal interest is in rational discourse, which leads to being right. That's what trips my trigger. I like that.
Yeah,
I don't
being right.
Anything that, right. I want to be right. And I don't want to be right in the sense of, you know, I'm right, you're wrong, because I want you to be right. I want us all to be right.
Absolutely.
And by right, it's not that we're having an argument, because we're not having an argument here. There's no I'm right, you're wrong here. What's right is we want to have a rational discourse so that we end up being right about what Yahweh said, right about understanding who he is, right about the covenant that he's offering, right about the conditions to that covenant, right about what the Torah means, right about how we should observe it. That's what we want to be right about.
And I'm going to tell you something else. If we're wrong, everybody's in trouble. I'm going to tell you that. Because there's nobody that can obey the Torah today. It cannot be done, folks.
Right.
It can't be done.
Right. Well, but it doesn't have to be done because we're never asked to do it.
No.
Yeah, well, yeah,
we
better be
it.
Right. Yeah, sure.
Right. So, there's for rational discourse, logical, rational, intelligent, evidence-based, consistent discussions about being right, about the instructions and understanding the instructions. You know, you can have, we bought the other day for our granddaughter a little jumper seat, and it came with instructions. And you can either follow the instructions and assemble it the right way, and your granddaughter's going to have a grand old time, or you can be wrong in the way you assemble it, and she's going to crack her head open. You know, there's times you want to be right. Now, as it relates to who God is and what he's offering, is there anything more important to be right about than that?
No.
So,
no,
should
I mean,
we be having a rational discourse about what it means to be right with God?
No. I mean, and it's another thing, you know, that it's like, you know, the crescendo, as you say, in the, you know, the Christian religion is he rises and nobody knows who he is.
Right, I know.
You know, I mean, this is kind of a sad state of affairs.
Yeah, that's wrong. Or that my God died for my sins, and the last thing he says before his body dies is, my God, why have you left me?
Right.
So, oops. I mean, why don't we have a rational discourse so we're right, not wrong?
You know, well, see, that's
one
the
of
whole
the
thing.
The word for evil, and there's like 8 different Hebrew words for evil. And every one of those words can be translated wrong. Evil is being wrong. Every one of the Hebrew words. They're all variations of ra and ra'an and the like. Every one of them can be translated wrong.
Interesting.
And so what we're looking for is a rational discourse about being right. About being right about everything? No. Do I really care if I'm right about who's going to win the Super Bowl next year? No. Do I want to pick the right numbers for the lottery? No, because I'm not going to play it. But I want to be right about life and the way of life.
Yeah, something that might be important, you mean? Yeah,
right. And there's only one source that's consistently right.
The other Torah.
Right. Mm-hmm.
You know, we were talking about that today, too. I mean,
I've got a question for you, Larry. Do you think that the Torah presents the covenant correctly?
Well, of course it does. It's the only place to get it.
Yeah, the only place it's presented. Right.
Yeah.
So the Torah obviously presents the covenant correctly. So if you read the Torah, you're going to be right about the covenant.
Yes.
That's not hard. Go ahead.
Yeah. If you seriously consider Yahweh's words, and I mean seriously consider them, think about them in a rational manner, there's only one path. I mean, we were talking about today. Kirk said, you know, there could be 29 paths. You know, 28 of them are wrong. You know,
right.
There's only one path.
Right.
I mean, that's it. And so, you know, anybody that says anything opposite from what the Creator said, who proves himself in verifiable manner through prophecy, mm-hmm. like this one about Paul that we just went through, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, that's a lot of time is spent on prophecy in Yahweh's words because he verifies all this stuff.
Right. There's only one reason, I'm sure there's a number of reasons for prophecy. The small reasons for prophecy is that it's there's a benefit to telling your children
it's a warning.
How things are going to turn out so they're prepared. I mean, that's a nice parental thing to do. And also, Yahweh uses prophecy to show cause and consequence and to teach us. All prophecy is filled with teaching. But the primary reason he uses prophecy is exactly what you've just said, Larry. He wants to prove that you can trust what he's saying, that if he's right about the future, then he's right about the covenant. It's that simple. So he proves that he's the right one to trust with prophecy. That's the sole purpose of it. All right.
Right.
So,
I mean, that's why you can look. Somebody told me about the Sumerian, and we're not talking about the Pentateuch necessarily, the cylinders,
mm-hmm.
you know, and great stories are made up of these cylinders, but there's no prophecy in them. And you know, if you don't have any prophecy, who cares what somebody wrote on a wall? I don't.
No, if it doesn't have Yahweh's seal, and Yahweh's seal is pretty straightforward. One is the person talking cannot be egotistical. They can't be presumptuous. The person who is presenting this has to be consistent with what Yahweh has said. They cannot contradict him. They have to get all time right, history right, and they have to get prophecy right. And it has to include both. And if they mention the names of any god other than Yahweh, it's not true. I don't care what the cylinders say. Listen.
Well, no, somebody in here just said they talk about the flood. There is eight cylinders. They talk about Noah. They talk about Moses, et cetera, and they talk about the flood. But they're wrong.
What more do you want to know about the flood than God provided a very specific set of instructions to Noah that Noah acted upon? And as a result of Noah listening to God and doing what God said, acting upon his instructions and engaging in the relationship, he and his family were saved.
Mm-hmm.
And that this was celebrated as a covenant with the rainbow of light. Well, what more? Other than maybe that God chose to wipe out people who were vicious and violent. because he doesn't like vicious and violent people.
No, to destroy his planet.
Right. Do I want to know any more about the storms at sea? And no, I really don't. I mean, I don't care if somebody's got a set of cylinders that they you know. The Torah says, "Don't add anything to it." Is the Torah a isn't the Torah where we learn about the flood?
Mm-hmm.
So why would we add something to it when God said don't? Now, it's one thing to say, well, I'm going to translate it with as many words as seem to make sense, so I'm going to provide an amplified translation. You're not adding to Yahweh's words. You're just adding
words,
more understanding to
speak in your language.
Right. You're adding to the understanding of his words. And then writing commentary on what he said, the sole purpose is to understand and to think about and to understand what he said.
Mm-hmm.
That's not adding to what he had to say. So that the whole thing of Enoch, for example, going back over the flood and having a contradictory account, that's not something that has any merit in my view. I was going to say, I could spend the next 1,000 years translating and commenting on the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. Why would you want anything more? And every time,
oh, I wouldn't.
Everything you open and everything you dig into is, it's got profound insights. Why would you want anything more?
No.
Why would you be looking
for
something more?
I agree with you. And if something doesn't contain prophecy, who do I know it's? How do I know who it's from? I really don't.
Well, you know it's not from Yahweh.
Yeah, I know that much.
Right. For the purpose of you closely examining and carefully considering, so as to protect you from the woman who is evil, repulsive, and offensive, severing the relationship, from the smooth and seductive tongue of the treacherous whore. This is the reason that William, the elevator man, sent this to us. He wanted to know who in the world this woman was. And the woman is the whore of Babylon.
The whore of Babylon, right. But the way
the woman is religion. She is politics. She is the institutions of man. She is Satan pretending to be God. That's who that woman is. She's the queen of heaven, the mother of God. She's Easter. She's Christmas.
Most especially manifest in the Catholic Church, actually.
Yeah, absolutely. Most adroitly manifest today in the Roman Catholic Church. So it's for the purpose of closely examining, carefully considering, so as to protect you from the woman who is evil, repulsive, and offensive, severing the relationship. Yahweh speaks of one of the Yoshe in one of the seven open letters, prophetic letters in Revelation, of the Roman Catholic Church being Jezebelian. Married to Jezebel means married to the Lord, married to Baal. That is the nature of religions. They're all seduced by the smooth and seductive tongue of the treacherous whore. And that's the adversary. It's the adulterous, disloyal harlot who seeks to break the marriage vow. And the reason she is presented as a whore is because of the fact that the covenant is a marriage vow. You should not genuinely or continuously covet or find desirable her beautiful and graceful appearance in your heart. Now, the reason I think God says this is that, and it's one of the more interesting things that I stumbled upon in writing, is that Satan is not who we think he is, or who most people think he is. Satan never wants to be worshipped as Satan. An occult ceremony is something that he has no interest in whatsoever. Satan wants to be worshipped as God. So Satan is the Lord of religions. He is the God of religions. Religious individuals are paying homage to, bowing down to Satan. The Lord Jesus Christ is satanic. The Allah is satanic. It's Hashem in rabbinical Judaism is satanic. adversarial. It is Satan's primary purpose to fool men into worshiping him as if he were God. And so rather than coming across as hideously ugly, as the devil, as the adversary, he does not want to be known as Satan, as the adversary. He wants to be known as God. He doesn't want to be thought of as ugly. He wants to be thought of as beautiful. So his religious establishments, his religious buildings, are the most beautiful buildings on earth. And if you want to take a tour of Europe, they're going to drag your sorry behind through 10 cathedrals a day.
Right.
God's saying,
Domo, literally.
Yeah, don't find those things desirable.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, beautiful appearance. Don't be seduced by the fact that Satan is coming across as beautiful. And do not let her actually obtain control over you on an ongoing basis with her flaunting display of flashing rays of light or flirting eyes. Yosha said that he saw Satan fall from heaven as flashing rays of light.
Mm-hmm.
Paul said that he saw his God as flashing rays of light on the road to Damascus.
Yes, he did. Falling.
Yeah. Don't allow her. I mean, Paul admits that he was demon-possessed. He said that his God was seen as flashing rays of light. God's saying, those flashing rays of light, don't let them take control of you. You know, God's not flashy. If you're seeing flashy rays of light in God, God is consistent. He's not flashy. God's not even showy. You got to look for him. You know, God could be as showy as he wants to be. And he is as showy as he wants to be, which is just not showy at all. You know, God's extraordinarily real, approachable, likable. Considering his position, he's daggone humble.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know what? I've got to say this too. You know, there are people that are in positions of authority and power in the world that are too damn good to talk to anybody, aren't they?
Yeah.
I mean, really.
Right. Yeah.
You know.
Oh, the abominator. He can't go across and talk to Congress. He wants to impose all sorts of executive edicts because he's not going to dignify them. And God's just flat out approachable. So long as you're not dragging religion and other political scum along with you, and you want to have a genuine relationship with him, he'll meet you. Meet with you anytime. Not too busy, not too proud, not too far removed. Right there at any time.
I mean, can you imagine that? I mean, you're talking, and just men think because of their stupid matrix that they've built, which is basically fraud on a house of cards. They've used all this fraud to exalt themselves and PR firms and everything else, and they're not even who they purport to be. These are the people that are too good to speak to the little people, and yet at the same time, the creator of the universe is there to meet with anybody who really wants to meet with him. That's astounding.
Correct. Yeah, it is. I was talking earlier about the fact that I think you said that I'm a fun guy. My relationship with God is fun. You know, I don't worship him. I don't blow smoke at him. I don't. I'm not awed by him. We have a fun time together. It's fun. And I know that a lot of people would say, that's sacrilegious. Well, it may be sacrilegious, but I don't think God wants them. But to have him. Awe him. He wouldn't have chosen the term. This is the covenant of your father. If he wanted us to be in awe of him.
Let me add an extra note to that. When we were, a few minutes ago, we were talking about beauty.
Mm-hmm.
Cafe.
Mm-hmm.
The oldest note, the oldest thing I have on that is beauty, a place, thing, or event that goes beyond the normal. miracle, sign, and wonders, the thing that Christians covet the most.
Yeah, of course, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
It's more than just don't be impressed with his cathedrals and his beauty.
Right. When, when we're told about Yosha's appearance, we're only told about Yosha's appearance in one place, and it's in the prophets. Were we told?
Yeah, Yahweh says there's nothing outstandingly physical about him.
Yeah,
or something
that's right.
Like that.
Yeah, there's nothing that would appeal to anybody.
And even though he did some extraordinary things, he didn't want to show off, or he would have dragged everybody up and said, "Look at there."
So he made fish and loaves of bread to nourish people. Well, that's his job. That's his business. Mm-hmm. But he doesn't show off. And even when he healed people, he would say, "I'm only doing this because I want you to recognize if I can do this to your physical body, what can I do to your soul?"
Yeah.
God's not showy. And so flashing lights, flirting, don't be lured in. So if we take a moment and compare the next proverb to Marshall 7:7 through 15. This is a really an interesting thing. This is something that Roy sent. This is kind of a paraphrase, but it says, "And in those lacking discrimination and judgment that I saw, I perceived among the children a youth lacking understanding, passing through the street near her corner, taking a path to her house at twilight in the evening. Daily in the darkness of midnight, behold, a woman met him, wearing the garments of a prostitute and possessing a cunning mind. She was rebellious, not satisfied with holding dominion in her family. Time and again in the street, time and again in the square, and beside every corner, she sets an ambush, and she laid hold of him and kissed him. With a shameless presence, she said to him, 'I have gone to confession,' thereby making a reconciliation with the God of Babylon. 'I have made a vow to the Mother of God, to the Queen of Heaven. Therefore, I have come out to meet you, to try to convert you to the Babylonian religion. And in this, I have been successful.'"
Wow.
That's Proverbs 7 through 15.
What talking about?
15.
Whoa.
Yeah. So you want to know who the woman
which
is.
Which one
she
was
the whore
it?
Of Babylon.
Which Masal was that?
7 through 15. That was, we have a friend, many of you have listened to him for a while. He's not a very bright guy, but we put up with him just because, you know, it's our job to be a accommodate Roy. You know, I'm kidding. Obviously,
right.
Roy's brighter than the rest of us combined. Roy, I asked Roy to read what I was writing and add things to it. And he says, "Okay, so now you're talking about this whore." Let me share with you something that I found in the very next proverb, in the seventh proverb. So that's how that made it. It came by way of Roy, one very smart, engaged guy. Now, that's another example. I am certain that Roy's relationship with Yahweh is different than mine because he's just so much smarter than I am. They have conversations at a different level. But...
he'll understand it.
But, you know, I enjoy learning about what he knows, what he has learned.
Sure.
It's, as we say, it's not a zero-sum game. The more wonderful relationships there are, the more different those relationships, the relationships may be, the better it is for all of us.
Well, you know, when we're out there in our 20 level 6 universes, you know,
yeah.
I might have a problem on my universe, and I have IT problems, as an example.
Yeah.
Hey,
yeah.
I'm calling Kirk in.
Oh, absolutely.
Hey,
yeah.
Kirk, I need some help over here, brother.
You know, you're looking for the new color for the platypus. You've got to create a platypus, but your platypus is going to be the color of the rainbow, and you need an artist. You're working some genes, and you need some understanding. Now, you're going to call Roy. And, you know, if you just want to chat for a while and want someone to appreciate your sense of humor, you may call me.
Yeah, that's true. You know what? And if you need a stick man drawn, like a stick figure kind of guy, you can call me. Because I'm there, man. I'm always there. Yep.
Well, the hang is
I'm just your basic
figure, so
guy.
That's okay.
Yeah, you know, I have probably received, I would guess, 500 emails regarding Roy.
Yeah.
And Roy is obviously a lot smarter than the rest of us.
Yeah.
And I have not heard a single person say, I envy Roy's intellect. I've not heard a single person say, you know, I don't appreciate, you know, him being, you know, so much smarter than the rest of us, or, you know, I wish I was that smart. Not a single person. They just say, you know, I really like what he has to say. I've learned a lot from what he has to say. I enjoy what he has to say.
So now, say we all.
This, yeah, and, you know, I've received a similar number, Kirk, on you, because of the approach that you take, the attitude that you take to Yahweh's testimony. Not a single person says, you know, I wish I could draw like him, or, you know, it's obvious that or I'm envious of his understanding. No, it's just all we enjoy what he has to say, and we've grown by it. And, you know, Larry, back in the day, I got more letters on you than anybody else, and they were pretty split between people thought you were you were the Larryinator, and. And you know, my response was always the same. Personally, I don't think it's offensive if you are being blunt and bold on Yahweh's behalf, because all I have to do is open most anything Yahweh, like this proverb where Yahweh says, these seven things I hate, and you know, six I hate, seven are an abomination. Or you look at what Yosha did when he was in the presence of the spiritual, or the religious and political leaders of his day. I mean, he was right in their face. I like that. I like God for that. I like you for that. I think it's a voice we need to hear. But the fact is, for the most part now, what you do that's so appealing to me is you always have, because you've collected these notes and you categorize them, you always have at your fingertips the right line to quote that helps us understand where we are, that adds to it.
It does.
Now, do I wish I had, you know, my translations all by categories like that, and I could just put my fingers on it at all the right time? Absolutely. But, you know, I'm glad that I've got a relationship with you, and you can do it for us.
Yeah, you know, right. And they're your translations, as a matter of fact, and that's fine with me. And I've been called a windbot, not in a long time, but I used to be.
Yeah.
When
I don't think that happens. Yeah. You know what? The reason I think that stopped happening, it used to happen. The reason I don't think it happens anymore is there's too many people now like you and Kirk and Roy and Frank and James and Scott. It goes on and on. Who have fought their way through this.
And nobody is quoting
me anymore. Now they're speaking of their own understanding.
Yeah, and we're putting information out there. I mean, Amy, who's a former Mormon, takes actually will take a picture and attach it to a passage, and then have a statement underneath of it. But these are accurate translations that people haven't seen. You know, people are more apt to read, you know, a passage than they are, say, seven passages in a note.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the
truth. I don't know how many times, for example, Richard, who Richard has, like you, Larry, used to be called
a windbag.
A derogatory term associated with me. And nobody does that anymore. Because I don't know if you've read some of Richard's responses when people write him. The guy's brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
He knows he has an understanding of his message. And when he communicates, he's not communicating from my perspective, he's communicating from Yahweh's perspective. And it's the fact that we all sound the same, there's a reason for that.
There's
just a straight answer for everything.
We're all
part
of the same
straight
family.
Answer.
That's
nobody
the reason we all sound
wizard.
The same. Right.
Right.
you know, you listen to the things that Lisa comes up with. She digs deeper on the subjects that are interesting to her, but she comes with the same answers because of the fact we're all reading the same script.
I think it's great.
That's the reason. And what we've ended up all doing is we've all used reason and a reason discourse to come to understand and to be right with God, and therefore we've taken it to heart, and now it just flows out of us. It's who we are. It's what we say. It's what we know. And there's just a tremendous confidence that comes with that.
Yeah.
Now, we don't have a lot more left on Proverbs 6, and we will complete Proverbs 6. I think we have like 9 statements left on Proverbs 6. But I'm going to tell you that so long as y'all don't mind the personal indulgence, because Psalm 91 was really, really personal to me. And I'm hoping that by keeping it as personal, that those who are listening, because, you know, Kirk and JB and Larry, you guys are already very upfront about exposing and condemning those things that need to be exposed and condemned, and sharing Yahweh's testimony.
Yes.
But there's a lot of people listening that may be uncomfortable doing that, may be a little bit timid to do so. And I think hearing what Yahweh promises and how you work together, and then seeing that, because there's going to be a lot of references to Prophet of Doom and questioning Paul, which mm-hmm. Out of that promise, I think it's going to be an interesting discussion. Psalm 91 is extraordinarily empowering. So we'll.
Now, have you shot that over to me yet? If you haven't, would you do that, please?
I will again. And what I'll do here is I will make certain I get. I think I've already sent you. One.
Is it Observations 1, 2, 3, and 4?
Yes.
Is that
1, 2, and 3 are complete? Yeah, 1, 2, and 3 are completed. Although I'm still soliciting input. I got some input from Richard on. On one today, Jackie has been editing 1, 2, and 3. But 1, 2, and 3 are done, with the exception of receiving more input. And I'm glad to take things out, add things to it, explain things better, share things that you guys come up with. 4 is not done yet. I'm about 4 or 5 verses away from completing the 91st Psalm. But it's well on its way.
May I tell something out of Devin? I read up a little bit ahead while I was doing the other stuff this week, but I only got about 3 passages, because I like to do it before I read your copy, just to see, to compare. But the thing that was so funny, I'm not funny, but so wonderful to me, is he promises all these things. I've read this thing for years. I mean, as a Christian, this was a go-to thing. And
oh, yeah, 91.
It went totally over my head, this part. And the one who says, he loves me because he knows my name. I just said, come on, guys. And all that time, nobody even knows his name or says it.
I know.
Everything is confusing
to me.
Because he loves me and because he knows my name, and I'm going, how do you wipe that out? Every church uses this.
Yeah. When we get to the 91st Psalm, I was just blown away as to how specific the promises are. And the thing that struck me, too, is that God provides far more than we even know to ask for.
Mm-hmm.
The list of what he's offering so vastly exceeded not only what I asked for, but what I could even think of, what I could even envision. And the deeper you look at the words, the more, the richer the offering becomes.
You know, there's a little thing that happened in the last probably 2 months.
I've got this up here after Jackie's edits. I've got it now.
Okay.
Or maybe she's still editing it, but I've got most of it, that's for sure.
Okay.
Up to 91, 11, anyway.
Oh, no, I'm way past there.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's where I'm up to here.
Okay. I'll shoot it to you this later today, probably actually not later today, but tomorrow or the following day as I get a little closer to being done. I'm on I'm right now on 9114, and doesn't sound like a big difference between 9111 and 9114. There actually is probably eight or nine pages of material because there's just a lot going on here.
Hey, I know something of you, Yada. Trust me.
Yeah.
I know there's a lot in between there.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot.
Yeah.
There's a lot going on. Yeah, there's a lot going on. It's some of the words are just amazing, and they're really worth analyzing, and so I've just constantly been struck with the depth of the words. But the other thing that's interesting is that having done so many translations now, and constantly been careful to look up the Dead Sea Scrolls and to correct the Masoretic for the Dead Sea Scrolls. This is by far the most divergent of anything that I've encountered. I mean, not even close. This is something where I would say 70% different in the Dead Sea Scrolls than it is in the Masoretic.
Wow.
When we're dealing with just, you know, this is not like the Great Isaiah Scroll, which is 13 to 15% different. This is 60 to 70% different. So,
so somebody just took the time to write their own Torah, didn't they? Yeah, well,
they did. Yeah, they just took the time to write their own. Yeah, and some of the times, I don't know what they were trying to achieve to change it, and I've decided, I'm not going to even attempt to go there. I'm just going to look at the oldest extant material and to translate it and to say, all right, this is what it means based upon the oldest extant material, and not even go to what they did.
I mean, you're talking about reality versus religion, and that's probably why they changed.
I don't know. I really, there are some places, I guess, it's pretty obvious where if it's the way it was written, wouldn't work for their religion. But oh goodness, it is. It's a powerful thing. You'll like it. It is really fun.
Wow.
Yeah, well, 60 to 70, somewhere.
And so that, that puts the Bible at near 90% wrong, I'll bet. I mean, it's got to be that worse.
Yeah. And, there's places where you're reading through it and the entire sentence is in italics. You know, how italics are used to show the difference.
Yeah.
And there are places where the entire sentence is in italics. There is.
Yeah, why would you do that? I mean, that's just insane. And then you're selling it as God's words. I mean, it's really weird.
For example, sixth verse, there isn't a single word in the sixth verse that is common between the two.
Unbelievable.
And the ninth verse, there isn't a single word that is common between the two. And the tenth verse, there's not a single word that's common between the two. And the 14th verse, not a single word that's common. The 15th verse doesn't even exist in the Dead Sea Scrolls, and the 16th has nothing in common. And then there's an end to it that's not in the Masoretic.
You mean the Torah? I mean, you mean...
Yeah, but the end is in the Dead Sea Scrolls. Didn't even make it
in the
Masoretic text.
I see.
Yeah. And the other thing that's interesting is that the Masoretic text just begins with the first statement. The Dead Sea Scrolls begins with, "This is a Mizmor of David," of Dod. Yeah. And the other thing that's interesting too is that we've got this order in the 92 is just kind of in the middle of the Psalms. Not according to the parchment that it was found on. It's the last of them. Yeah, it's the very last of them, according to the parchment that it was found on. So it's just all sorts of things. Pretty amazing.
And, you almost wonder why they did it. I mean, I understand in Bibles why they did it. I really do. I completely get it in Bibles. I mean, if they had people able to see what Yahweh really said, they couldn't fill a church. I mean, they couldn't have the convolution of a new testament. You know, they couldn't confuse people so readily or easily. But you know, and when I look at words like, you know, when I look at the psalm, what was it, in the 119th, where he talks about praise. You know, praise me. You praise me seven times a day, you know, and then you look at it and the word praise isn't even in there, and the rest. I get it. What they're trying to do is have a religious deity that needs praise all the time. Because, after all, they need praise, right? I mean, that's what's happening there. But it, of course, makes no sense either. Which is really why Christians can't make sense of their Old Testament. It wasn't written to make sense. It was written to cover up the sense it honestly made. Yeah. You know,
good reason to call it Babel.
But I just don't see why the Masoretes did that so often. I mean, it's not all about Yahusha. I always see them stumble and fall when it comes to Yahusha or anything pointing to Yahusha. But to just rewrite entire passages is just, it's just insane. Whoever did it is insane.
You know what the Christian view of this psalm is? They call it fourth exorcism psalm.
Really?
Exorcism.
I haven't found that.
Yeah.
Wow.
Exorcism. Yeah, there's a... The psalm that precedes it is not numbered. It didn't even make the Masoretic text. Is called the third exorcism psalm, which is that Yahweh has the power, the Lord has the power to strike down demons. And then there's a first and a second exorcism psalm, and they're called the four psalms against demons.
Wow.
Now, there are two demonic references in the 91st psalm. It does speak of the horned viper, the serpent, and of the dragon. The dragon is, and the serpent are both metaphors for Satan. But it's not about casting them out. It's about preventing them from being able to influence those who are working on behalf of Yahweh in any way. So Yahweh assigns his Malach the specific duty of making certain that the satanic emissaries have no influence over you.
Well, I think so. Yeah. I think I can.
Wouldn't be much of a need for an exorcism then, would it?
No. There is no need for an exorcism.
Yeah, let me ask you a question. When you are referring to the Dead Sea Scrolls, do you have like a Dead Sea Scrolls Bible that they sell, or do you? Or
yeah, what I use. It's called the Dead Sea Scrolls Bible.
Okay.
It's published by Harper. It's compiled by Abig, Flint, and Urich. And what it does is extremely helpful. What it does is it puts in italics the differences between the Dead Sea Scrolls and the Masoretic text.
Right.
So it puts in italics the things that are different. Now, so the translations that they provide are no better than the translation you find in any English Bible. But they highlight by putting in italics what's different, and then they footnote it down below. So if, for example, this says that...
He who dwells.
Yeah, it says nor the plague that destroys at noon, or the pestilence that stalks in the darkness. That was all in italics.
Yeah.
So now what I have to do is then I have to look at a concordance. If I'm, if the word plague is not, like in this particular case, plague was used previously, so I can just look it up previously. But each word that is in italics, they don't provide the Hebrew word. I've got to look up the Hebrew word.
Oh,
and like, for example, it says, for you have invoked your shelter. Well, you know, if you look at the Strong's, which is the easiest concordance to use, they don't have any Hebrew word translated evoked. And so now if you're going to translate that, you've got to use much more sophisticated tools to find out what is the word in Hebrew that can be translated evoke.
Mm-hmm.
And what you find is the only word that can be translated correctly, be translated evoke in that context. I spend hours on that particular word to find the, because they don't picture the scroll. So you can't read it from the fragment, because they only picture small sections of the fragments. And the scroll that 91 is found on is also the same scroll that the 119th is found on. And so you can't go to it and say, I want to look at that section and just read the letters. So you have to look up, find out what is the Hebrew word that can be translated, evoked in that context. And what I determined it was is kara.
Hmm.
You know, the word for invite, to summon, to call out.
Hello. Yeah.
Yeah, to welcome, to but to the word that was there that they replaced was kara. And so it's,
and what word did they replace it with? Evoke?
Well, no, they didn't have evoke. Evoke is the Dead Sea Scrolls translation of the word that is on the scrolls that is not in the Masoretic. The Masoretic has 177. The Masoretic reads, for you have made the Lord, who is my refuge, yes, the Most High, your dwelling place. So, for you have made the Lord. I don't know how you make the Lord. Who is my refuge, yes, the Most High, your dwelling place. That's the Masoretic text. And the passage in the Dead Sea Scrolls reads, for you have invoked your shelter, which is your delight. And now what you need to do, if you want to render it from the Dead Sea Scrolls, is you've got to go and look up, say, what is the word for delight? Because it's not found in the Masoretic text. And so what is the word for delight?
They've changed 70% of it. I mean, those two, they don't even mean the same things or say the same things.
So now if I'm providing the translation, what I have to do, because I have a lot of people that check the translations, I have to put constantly in brackets from the this particular scroll. This one is 11 Q11PS. So this word is from Q11PS. It's this word in the Masoretic text. You know, otherwise somebody look up the, you know, on an interlinear and say, wait a minute, what are you doing here? These words don't appear.
Yeah,
because they're looking at SMT or whatever.
Right. But all of the tools, the lexicons and dictionaries, they're all, and all the interlinears are based on the Masoretic.
That's right.
So the way that you get back to older extant material is you look at where are the differences between the Dead Sea Scrolls and the Masoretic text, and then you look up, okay, when Dode uses the word for delight, what word does Dode use for delight? And because, you know, there may be 10 deeper Hebrew words that can be translated delight. When Dode uses the concept of evoke, what word does he choose to communicate that? So, now, you don't have that problem in Isaiah, Yashayah, because every part of the great Isaiah scroll has been photographed, and you can look it up online. So there you can, it's a word that you're struggling with, you can actually look at the scroll. So, it's not expensive. It's just, I've got two of them. Yeah, it's called the Dead Sea Scrolls Bible. And the translation is horrible, but the information provided is extremely useful if you're willing to spend the time. It's because all it does is put in italics where they're different, and then it explains the difference in the footnote.
Yeah, you certainly can't rely on religious material. I mean, it's just so awful, and it's purposefully awful. And you know what kills me is that people run around talking about it like it's the word of God. It is not. It's the word of a bunch of scribes that were involved in religion.
Well, particularly when you look at the Christian New Testament.
No, it's just That's rubbish. It's rubbish.
Right.
I mean,
you've got three books there that I think have maybe three and a half that have some merit. But even then, you've got to get past all of the scribal errors, not just errors. They were deliberate copy edits. And then you've got to get back by the fact that it was written and spoken in Hebrew, and it was translated to Greek, and then you got to change the Greek back to Hebrew before you translate it into English. I mean, it's
I've done some of that. That's tough.
Yeah.
It's be crazy.
Yeah, it's not hard with most of what's written in Matanyah, because you just the Hebrew screams through Matanyah. It's easy to see what he really said. But that's not true across the board. You know, when you... Yao Kanan's, it's tougher to get back to the Hebrew. And then it's not so hard in Revelation, just because the fact that Revelation is so parallel to
Daniel.
To Daniel, yeah.
Yeah. Next week on Observations, you want to finish here or you want to go to 91?
I think I want to finish here with Observations, and then we'll go to 91 for this program. Does that work for you?
Sure, absolutely.
Yeah, and then I've got to figure out a way. I think I would like to share some of the personal insights that are just in the commentary on 91 and not just read the text, because the text, the two are so entwined. In that mission, and you know, we have so little time left that the world needs other people to go off and expose and condemn Paul and Muhammad and Akiba and the like.
You know what I was going to say earlier, I think Larry and I talked about it, but you know how we were dumbfounded when we found Chabrook and the plague of death, and since in the last, maybe 3 months or 4 months at the most. There's nothing but plague of death.
Yeah, it's just everywhere. It's everywhere. It's everywhere.
Babylon, Whore of Babylon, Astarte. This is
everywhere.
You're talking about billions of people dead, so it's a big issue. You know,
it's a big issue. No. Yeah, it's a big issue.
But I mean,
I was a little uncomfortable that, particularly in family discussions, that we were constantly harping on Paul. I don't feel uncomfortable at all, because God does for a reason. Billions of people. Billions of people. Scumbag. Yeah.
Well, you know, I mean, you get to a point where, you know, have you ever seen the movies, you guys, where they're rolling up on Troy or something, and they have the priests out talking to the gods, and of course, you know, it's ridiculous. Everybody today knows it's ridiculous, and they got the six statues, and you know, somebody saw an eagle carrying a snake, and it meant this and that, and you go, yeah, well, how stupid was that religion? And then you've gotten to a point where you look at Christianity and you realize it's the exact damn thing.
Same thing. Yeah, you know, I didn't watch it, and I couldn't watch it, but I know that somebody in the chat room mentioned having seen it, but they had the movie Crucifixion that played I guess on Fox last night or the night before, and it just how stunningly pagan all of its themes are.
Is that the one that old Mel Gibson did?
I don't think.
New one in New Orleans or something.
Very Catholic, so that's,
yeah. No, his version was based upon the dream that a nun had.
Oh, okay.
Passion of the Christ was based upon a dream of
I
a nun.
I thought that, yeah. In any case, it's, I would assume
I thought, that it, was I thought it made me sick.
Yeah, I bet.
It made me sick. He makes me sick. Yeah. Roman Catholic Church makes me sick. Religion makes me sick.
Yeah.
It makes everybody sick. They just don't
it
know
does.
It.
Yeah, in fact, God uses the term disease over and over and over again.
Yeah.
Talking about
I keep translating plague. Everywhere I go, it says plague.
Plague, disease.
All the old terms are plague.
Yeah. You know, I had a friend that she was a former nun.
Mm-hmm.
And then she was married to a pastor.
Okay.
And ended up calling him Sister Lardass. Actually, because they had this, they had some parishioner that was always calling him that. She thought it was hilarious, and she said as a pastor's wife, she was just assaulted by women that were always coming on to her husband. Basically, as a matter of fact.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Yeah, her name's Lorraine, and she walked away from it all. Now she never walked into the truth, but she did walk away from all that. And
there is so much sexual perversion in Christianity. But you know what's it's interesting is that the religion is so hypocritical because they're fixated with promiscuity, condemning promiscuity, and they're guilty of the very things that that they condemn.
Yeah, well, it's like the me thinks he protests too loudly thing, you know, where the thief puts five locks on his doors type of situation. I mean, that's what it is.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
And anybody can see it. But what she said, and I trained her for some years in a gym, she said, I never realized that the gym was so healthy. Now, you would think somebody would just realize that, you know. But she said, because I can tell you the sickest place on the planet is a church. That's what she told me. I said, yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, that's pretty
much. She said, it is the sickest place on the planet is a church. That was her her thing. And she had lived through the nonsense and, you know, for like 14 years. And that was enough for her as a pastor's wife and as a former nun. Can you imagine this? Her parents at 19 put her in a convent. And the story she tells, it's straight up abuse, man.
Yeah.
I mean, the mother superior comes in and just abuses the hell out of you.
Yeah.
If they find out something hurts you, that's what they make you do.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean,
they're
it's just perverted. An abuse factory. Oh, it's total perversion.
Yeah. But not just that, it's Hadassic Judaism. Same thing. You know, I'm sure that if the Amish weren't conditioned the same way, where it's considered, you know, this grievous sin to tattletale on the perversion, that it's rampant in the Amish community and the Mennonite community, and the as well as the we know it's rampant in Islam and rampant in Roman Catholicism, but it's a big deal in the Hadassic community in Judaism.
I worked with two former Amish. They were a husband and wife team in the insurance business. And they had seven kids, the two of them did, and they had been ostracized. You know, the community had turned their back on them, whatever. And, boy, they had nothing good to say about the Amish. They were both former Amish that were, you know, booted out. And they had nothing kind to say about it. Nothing at all.
I have a husband and wife. I have several children that I think listen to this program. But I know they've read all of Yada Yah and Intro to God. And they correspond fairly often. They both broke out of the Mennonite, which is Amish-like Mennonite community.
Oh, sure. Yeah, it's just step up. You can drive a car or something now. Yeah.
Oh, basically. They left it. They left it and are part of the covenant now, and they're raising their children to be part of the covenant.
Good for them.
And it's the difference is just night and day, and they realize now how phony and crude and raw and evil all of that was, how fake it all was.
There's an awful lot going on now about the Clinton family and how absolutely perverted it is. As long as, and do you remember what was the president of Panama that they went after?
Noriega.
No, there you go. And they wanted to kill him.
Yeah, pineapple.
But the stupid captain didn't do it. He arrested him. And he's still alive in prison. But the reason they didn't get him is because he had all the films of all the congressmen and people coming down to have their sexual perverted things going on down in Panama. And he filmed it all for years. And they said the reason is why they wanted him shot.
Well, he was smart, wasn't he?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And that's why he's in prison today, because originally they said, we don't want to bring him out alive. Shoot him. Couldn't find, they arrested him, but they couldn't find his stuff, and they know he's got it somewhere. And he filmed every congressman, every senator. And it was supposed to be reported on by
the Republican. The FBI has files, and that's where the NSA stays in business.
There's nobody in this beltway that they don't have.
Correct.
It is a sick group.
They're made man.
You know what? They all may be Scientologists.
Well, they certainly are in Hollywood.
Well, that's the total sign. You know how the Scientologists work. They make you confess it all, and then they write it all down.
Well, no. Yeah. Then if you want to move up the ranks, you got to get other people to confess and write everything down about everybody. It's like a giant blackmail program. I have never in my life seen such an insane religion as that. I mean, it's just like an op. It's like a black op.
Yeah, it is.
It's bizarre to me. Who in the hell could... You know, I could see, you know, somebody... You get somebody in emotional low, they're looking for the truth, and you could pull them into, you know, practically any religion. But you can't get anybody to stay unless you have, you know, at least
that's
something.
Good.
Well, I mean, to offer, I would think, I mean, how do you sit there and you go, okay, Craig, tell me, what are some of the worst things you've ever done in your life? And you stand there in this emotional, oh, well, I did this, I did that. And you got somebody writing this stuff across from you. And
oh, you're recording
it. 2 weeks, 2 weeks later, they got you saying, now, can you do this to your friends?
Yeah.
You know, and give me the papers.
Right.
And move up the ladder, getting information.
Right.
I mean, how insane might this be? I mean, at some point, wouldn't you pinch yourself and say, I need to wake up? I mean, whoa, come on, man.
Those people that are blackmailing me do not have my best interest at heart.
Yeah. I just said, when I saw the top guy, and I guess he was right under the head monkey muck up there, that walked away from Scientology, and he's got this 2-hour documentary, and another woman who was
almost ill. Unbelievable.
I couldn't believe this program. They line him up, they make him wash walls, they smack him upside the head, won't let him eat for days at a time, and all they're doing is gathering information.
What's that? Like military hazing.
Yeah.
Oh, it's worse than military.
Military hazing with blackmail.
Yeah. It's just I never really knew. I knew that Ron L. Hubbard was just a jerk and a nut, and claimed to be.
And he quoted it based on a dare of that,
he was a science fiction writer. I have friends that knew him and been into science fiction writers, and he had a very fertile mind. He could just keep on going and make up anything. And
you had friends that knew this guy. What did they say about him?
The lady I used to illustrate some books for, and I probably did about 9 little children's science fiction books, and she knew him because they used to go to, what do they call them, these conventions and things, and they, all the authors talk. She wrote about 50 books, so she would be on the dais, to talk about things, and he would be on that. So she knew him and knew of him and knew people who knew him well, and, she tells some interesting stories, but,
The two most recent religions in America are the two most moronic, Mormonism and Scientology.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I just can't imagine anything getting worse than Scientology. I just can't.
Mormonism's pretty bad.
Mormonism is stupid.
It's stupid.
Well, you can look in the box, but then, your faith is gone if you look in the box. So do you want to have faith or do you want the proof? Which do you want? Well, I don't want to anybody to prove anything. Yeah, of course. South Park did a thing on it that was just absolutely
Oh, I know. It's hilarious.
Boring.
I know.
Hilarious.
Yeah.
So I get
dumb,
that.
Dumb, 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 dumb.
Yeah. Dumb, 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 dumb. Yeah. And, you know, I was laughing my ass off listening to this stuff.
Yeah.
But, you know, when
yeah.
I watched the Scientology thing, documentary, and this guy was straight up. He was telling the truth about what happened to him in Scientology. And they used terms just like NSA. Like, I had to go wipe the place down, you know.
Yeah,
I had to burn all the information and everything, you know. And you're sitting there going, well, what is supposed to be at the end of all this? And you sign a billion-year contract with these guys. It's the most insane thing I've ever seen. Like I say, you could pull somebody into it, but wouldn't
they? You know what's amazing is that there is a billion-year contract, and you don't even have to sign it.
Mm-hmm.
No.
Yeah, they're even more than a billion years.
But it is a billion years. Of course, it's a lot more than a billion years, but it's a billion-year contract.
It's the one I'm in here.
Yeah, I'm in on it, but I don't recall.
Everybody we know just about now.
And, you know, there wasn't a single time I was asked to confess.
No. In fact, the thing is,
should I have confessed, everything I would have said would have been forgotten. But rather than having to confess, everything that I've ever done that's rotten was obliterated.
I like that.
So rather than keeping a record of it, it was obliterated. The record of it's gone.
Yeah, and I think we all eat our own peace alone, don't we?
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that right?
Yeah.
Yeah, we all eat our own peace alone, so I don't have to worry about what you've done either. I don't even care.
No.
What do you think
it's irrelevant to you because it's irrelevant to God.
That's right.
They're totally irrelevant.
Here.
Not
here, here.
Worse, I mean, less than irrelevant. Unknown.
Yes.
Yeah, that's the interesting thing, this whole confession of sin. There's no place where Yahweh tells us to confess. Not interested in it.
It's a ploy. It's a great power.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, fellas. Well, that was fun.
Enjoyed it. Stay.
Yeah,
you know,
I
enjoyed
it. Thank you for
filling
in for me while I was playing in the mud.
Hey, it was good being your yes man today, Kirk. It was nice.
You know, God was scared to death. He was really worried about you, and I didn't know to be worried. I just thought you had some.
Scott wrote me two letters. He says, "Oh man, it was the easiest show I ever had to do." It's just Larry and Kirk called in. They just had a great conversation.
Everybody's probably going to write you this week and say, "You are okay, aren't you? Please come back."
You know the damnedest thing here, and this is the truth. It just for the first time in 3 weeks, I slowed down to a slow run where I could phone Andy about an hour. I met Scott and said, "Scott, is the show on yet?" And he said, "No, it'll be on in about an hour." So about an hour later, I called back. He's, "We've been waiting for you. Craig isn't showing up today."
I
was like, wow. What, you know, how do you like that?
I
mean, that's weird, isn't it?
I'll tell you what. He was thrilled, and so was Kirk.
I was thrilled.
I wish I would have known, Kirk. I would have just
turned
it on.
I'm not the one.
I just listened to you read for an hour. And then I would have called in and said, "You need some help, man?"
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, you guys have a good one. I enjoyed tonight.
Happy Shabbat.
Bye-bye.
Bye.